territory. It was not immune from suits for causing damage to property. I'm going to talk a little bit later about some of the early judges of the Minnesota courts. This one, I kind of quoted some language here that I thought was kind of interesting. And it's not a very remarkable point, so I'm not going to get cited for that. But you kind of get the impression that some of these early judges, they were pretty good judges. The kind of judge wouldn't mind appearing before because they kind of seemed to understand what was going on. In this case, it's just making the rather unimportant point that you have to raise objections to things at trial. But the quote I put here is he's saying, well, you have to give some specificity to your objections. You can't call upon the trial judge to analyze a mass of legal maxims and solve a long series of problems to find a true result. If you have an objection to something, you have to raise it with particularity. And of course, that was more true out in the frontier, because chances are your judge did not have much of a library at his disposal right at the trial. So you need to raise it more specifically rather than just making this broad objection and hoping to have it reversed on appeal. Now, talk a little bit about the court structure in the territory. As I mentioned before, I think there were five officers that were, five territorial officers that were appointed by the president with the advice and the consent of the Senate. And those were the governor, the secretary, and the three judges of the Supreme Court. And how the courts work, the entire court system consisted of those three judges. And anytime two of them were in the same room, the Supreme Court was in session. And any two of those three judges were able to act in the name of the Supreme Court. But they also, those three judges also served as trial judges. The state was divided up into three districts. So each judge was responsible for trial court in each of those districts. And the court was held at Stillwater, St. Paul, and Mendota. Again, the three leading settlements in the era. And the Chief Justice, I don't know if it was by statute or just his choice, but the Chief Justice typically held district court at Stillwater. And then the other two associate justices held court in the other areas. And then, of course, there were justices of the peace for minor matters. But they had terms, and the judge would ride into town and hold court. The first judge of the Supreme Court, kind of an interesting story. The first judge was Aaron Goodrich, and he was succeeded by Jerome Fuller. Well, Goodrich was, all of these officers were basically political appointees, and in the early territorial years, the Whig Party was in power. So most of these men who served as governor and as judges were so because they had been loyal members of the Whig Party, and it was kind of a political spoil we sent out here. If you look through the names of those early judges, which are actually printed later in the materials, but if you look through there, some of them look vaguely familiar. Some of them look totally unfamiliar. Well, the ones that look vaguely familiar are the ones that stuck around after their terms were over and became part of the fabric of the state. And typically, they got a county named after them or a city or something. So that's the ones that look vaguely familiar. The names that don't have a county named after them, as far as there's no Goodrich County, is there? I don't think so. Well, the reason why they're in the county is named after them is because they headed back east. Now, Goodrich, the first Chief Justice, was appointed to me by President Taylor. And then when President Taylor died, his successor was Pierce. But anyway, but in any event, the Judge Goodrich had had an earlier run-in with the new president. Somebody takes the office of president of the United States, and you think, oh, I know him. Oh, but I know him from the incident back in New York. So he wasn't particularly popular with the new president, and he was removed from office by the president. Now, the law apparently was not clear as to whether what the status was. Goodrich referred to himself in some writings as a federal judge, which he was. So he was asking, so there's really a question of once he was appointed by the president with the advice and consent of the Senate for a term of 4 years or whatever, whether the president had authority to remove him. I think it was a legitimate issue. It was solved rather easily when the U.S. Treasury apparently went along with the people who said that yes, the president did have this power, and they stopped sending him his salary, and at that point he stopped the fight. But he served here for about 2 years, from 1849 to 1851, and then Jerome Fuller was appointed by the next president, and he came here and he held the court. Wrote opinions, including this opinion here that I just quoted. He was appointed by the president, and he set sail for Minnesota, but it wasn't, once he arrived here, he assumed his duties, but he was not confirmed by the Senate, and that word did not make it to Minnesota for a couple months later. So when that word got here, he was sent packing. And both of those gentlemen, Goodrich and Fuller, I think they went on to become county judges or trial judges in some eastern states, but their days in the Minnesota frontier were over. They were sent packing back to the east. But if you, on a couple pages more, if you look through some of those names, again, some of them will look kind of vaguely familiar because the ones that are familiar are the ones that stayed on and got a county named after them. If you look through that first volume, the first volume of Minnesota Reports, there are 81 cases in there. Some of them are the opinion is missing because they were not actually bought into a volume until a few years later. So by the time that happens, so many of the hits have been lost. Although there's a kind of notation of the names of the parties that they put in there, but there are about 80 cases. Kind of look through the list, you can kind of see I just kind of pick the main topic from each one just to kind of give some idea of what's in that book. As you can see, the things like civil procedure and trial court jurisdiction and appellate jurisdiction, those seem to be the main questions. But you can, as you go through there, you can kind of see the commerce starting to develop because, that a lot of as you move later in the book, you start to see a lot more cases about negotiable paper, contracts, and the kinds of trappings of commerce. You can really see that starting to grow. So again, many of those cases are just merely interesting, and some of them might be solid precedents. If a steamboat crashes into somebody's lodge, you have the case for it. But there are some cases in that little book, and in the territorial statutes, in some of the territorial laws, that take on added significance because, in some cases, the law as it existed in immediately prior to 1858 is kind of locked into place by the Constitution. And where that's most explicitly the case is in question of the right to trial by jury. Now, many state constitutions, but not Minnesota, are very explicit about this. and they include the words as heretofore.